This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It has been more than a week since Adam Howe died by apparent suicide in his jail cell, and it continues to raise questions about the systems in place for those who are struggling with mental health and who are involved in the criminal legal system here in Massachusetts. So here is what we know. Police arrested Adam Howe in Truro after finding him with the burning remains of his mother. He was taken to a hospital, and while there, Cape and Islands District Attorney Michael O'Keefe sought his commitment to a state psychiatric facility. The facility, Bridgewater State Hospital, refused to admit him because of a legal technicality. He went to jail instead and died the next day. From the newsroom, WBUR's Deborah Becker joins us to take a look at how the system worked or didn't in this case. Deb, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And I do just want to note quickly, if you or a loved one are struggling with a mental health crisis or suicidal feelings, you can call the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. So, Deb, that was a very quick boiling down of what we know. There are other important details there. What else is important for us to understand?
Well, after Mr. Howe was arrested for the murder of his mother, Susan Howe, he was taken to Cape Cod Hospital because he indicated that he was having trouble breathing. Now, the hospital was holding him as the Cape and Islands District Attorney was seeking to commit Mr. Howe to Bridgewater. The DA said he sought that commitment because Mr. Howe had expressed suicidal thoughts and had a history of mental illness. A key issue is that the judge agreed with the DA for a psychiatric commitment, but ordered it under the state law known as Section 12. That law, though, is for a civil commitment, not for someone who is criminally charged. And Bridgewater correctly said it does not accept commitments under Section 12, but under a different law. So it's not clear why someone, perhaps the police, the DA, or the jail, didn't ask the judge to amend the order and get the Bridgewater commitment under the correct law. And of course, as you said, Mr. Howe was then found unresponsive in his jail cell the next day.
All right, so Deb, a couple of things that I want to break down there before we go forward with the latest on the case. So first, Bridgewater State Psychiatric Hospital is essentially operated under the Department of Corrections, right? So it often works with people who are in incarceration.
That's right.
Okay. Second, there are a couple of different ways in the state that one is allowed to involuntarily commit someone else for either psychiatric observation or treatment, right? And that's what these sections are, like Section 12, right?
That's right. It's pretty complicated. Essentially, Section 12 is for a general civil mental health commitment, and that's for someone whose mental health is considered dangerous, and it typically allows for up to a 72-hour commitment. The law does not allow, that law, Section 12, does not allow for a commitment to Bridgewater because it's primarily for those who are involved in the criminal legal system, Bridgewater. Now, there are two other laws which do allow commitments to Bridgewater. Those are for things, say you want to determine someone's competency to stand trial or if someone in the legal system needs a psychiatric hospitalization. So typically, in cases like Mr. Howe's, a commitment like this would be done under the law known as Section 18. And the Department of Correction said it followed legal protocol, and Bridgewater does not accept Section 12 commitments, and that's entirely correct.
And so basically, that was super helpful. So basically, Mr. Howe would have been coming in through the wrong door, and Bridgewater wasn't allowed, they say, to accept him through that civil door versus a corrections door, basically.
That's correct.
All right. That's really helpful. So now the death happened several days ago now. Are there any updates in this case?
Well, the Bristol County Sheriff, Thomas Hodgson, who runs the Ash Street Jail, where Mr. Howe was in custody, is maintaining that he took the necessary precautions to protect Mr. Howe. The sheriff said his officers checked every 15 minutes on Mr. Howe, that he was wearing suicide-proof clothing. Hodgson's office says Cape Cod Hospital cleared Mr. Howe to be in custody, to go into custody. And the sheriff was not aware of the attempts for a psychiatric commitment to Bridgewater. He said if the sheriff had known that, there would have been additional safety measures put in place. However, the district attorney says that when Mr. Howe was taken to Bristol County to the jail, his discharge summary from the hospital and a police report indicated suicidal ideation.
So the issue there, Deb, if I understand it, has to do with the level of observation offered in the at the jail based on the level of risk to Mr. Howe's safety through his suicidal ideation. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's right. Should the jail have monitored him more closely because of what was going on? And also, should the jail have then moved for a Section 18 commitment?
And this should be, in the end, knowable, right, because of paperwork, what the sheriff's office or the jail did or didn't know?
That's right.
Okay, so Deb, and we're going to bring a second voice in just a minute, but you have a lot of experience for reporting both on the criminal justice system and its intersection with the mental health system. Is this a perfect storm of failures here, or is there something sort of more not surprising because of the faults in our system? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Mm-hmm, I do. I think it's mixed. I think that the Cape District Attorney Michael O'Keefe said this case shows that the mental health system is broken, especially for those in the criminal legal system. And a significant percentage of those in the criminal legal system are struggling with mental health issues. With Mr. Howe's history and his suicidal ideation, and with multiple agencies involved in both healthcare and law enforcement, it's really not clear why Mr. Howe seems to have fallen through the cracks and was not more closely monitored or evaluated.
This is our From the Newsroom here on Radio Boston. We're talking about a tragic case of a death in jail and potential breakdowns in our mental health and criminal legal system. Deborah Becker from WBUR is with us. Deb, I have one more question I want to ask you, and then I'm going to bring in an additional voice. I feel like we should address this. In your reporting, it seems clear that there was that. Okay, let me backtrack and do it this way. How did Mr. Howe wind up at the Ash Street Jail in Bristol County?
The district attorney said that after Bridgewater would not commit Mr. Howe, state police contacted county jails to hold him, which is customarily done in these cases, and Bristol County said he could be placed in custody there. An issue that prisoners' rights advocates have brought up is that suicide is a problem in Massachusetts county jails in particular. That's as opposed to prisons. There aren't a lot of hard numbers about jail suicides, but Prison Legal News published a report earlier this year that said 62 prisoners in Massachusetts died by suicide between 2006 and 2016, and that is some of the most recent data available. And Bristol County is known to have a higher rate of prisoner suicides compared with other county jails. A state audit done just a few years ago showed this higher rate in Bristol County.
All right. So first, I'm going to note quickly for listeners again, if you or a loved one are struggling with a mental health crisis or suicidal feelings, you can call the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. Deb Becker, stand by. I'm going to bring a second voice in. Philip Kessel is the executive director of the Mental Health Legal Advisors Committee. Philip, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Philip, I want to begin. You were hearing my conversation, Deb's and my conversation there. Is there anything that you want to clarify or add to? Because a lot of this is all of us just trying to understand how this system works.
No, I think Deb has it right. I think the way that the issue is being parsed in the course of your discussion is correct. There, you could look at it as a perfect storm of individual screw-ups. And also a systemic problem, and I think there are elements of both in this story.
One of the things, as sort of a layperson, Philip, that surprised me in this situation was that there was a disconnect between a prosecutor's office who wanted mental health treatment and the legal process that then kept essentially the door closed at Bridgewater State for Mr. Howe. Is that unusual, that disconnect between a prosecutor's office and our criminal legal system, the rest of our criminal legal system?
You know, I don't know how unusual it is, but there is a protocol in place that was instituted by the trial court for dealing with this very situation that District Attorney O'Keefe apparently didn't know about, and neither did anyone else. Even given that lack of understanding, you know, of this protocol, which allows for transfers under these circumstances, there was also a failure to just go a little bit out of your way, you know, to make sure this guy stayed safe.
And what would that have looked like?
Well, they could have called the judge and say, hey, you issued this order under the wrong statute. You know, do it under Section 18. We're here. You know, or and Bridgewater should have known that was possible and not simply just refused, but say, okay, send them back. Let's handle this paperwork a little differently. Any number of people could have done that. There's something of a callousness involved in all of this.
So as somebody who works in mental health, was this a surprising set of events to you? I don't mean to be voyeuristic about this, Philip. Was this a surprising set of events to you, or did you think, given our system, this was bound to happen? Again, I don't want to be callous. I just want to understand.
I wouldn't go so far as to say bound to happen. At the same time, it's not surprising. This man should not have died, even with the screw ups that occurred here. He should have been able to maintain safely at the Bristol County House of Corrections, if only just overnight. The problem is that Bristol County routinely ignores its own protocols. There's a number of cases pending that demonstrate this with respect to both the jail itself and their contracted psychological care provider.
So we're speaking with Philip Castle, who's executive director of the Mental Health Legal Advisors Committee, and we've also still got on the line WBUR reporter Deb Becker. So Deb, this is a good chance to come back. In your reporting, had you reached out to the Bristol County Sheriff's Office? What has the back and forth with them been?
Well, they have essentially maintained that they followed correct procedures. And initially they said that they were not going to be making a comment, but I think they got a lot of inquiries. And then they said that Mr. Castle had died, and they explained how he died, which was very tragic. He apparently had stuffed his airways with wet toilet paper, and he was found in his cell not breathing, and then he was later pronounced dead at St. Luke's Hospital. And then they issued a statement saying, we never knew that anybody was trying to commit Mr. Howe to Bridgewater State Hospital. So there's essentially been a lot of finger-pointing going on.
And again, Deb, you had alluded to this earlier, but a little more data from some reporting from the Sun Chronicle. In a report that came out in 2018, it found that more than a quarter of all suicides in the state's 13 county jails occurred in Bristol County in the preceding 6 years. Okay, so back to you, Philip Castle. Are there particular weak spots, pain points, faults in our system that you have particularly wanted to see addressed and or are particularly laid bare by this case that we're also, I think, hit by?
Well, besides the, you know, utter failure on the part of Bristol County to protect prisoners in their care who are apparently suicidal. And by the way, I'm not in a position to make a credibility finding between the district attorney and Sheriff Hodgson, but the district attorney's press release indicates that he was under a constant eyeball watch at Cape Cod Hospital. The fact that they would not put the notion that they wouldn't include a suicidal ideation in the discharge summary is a little hard to believe. Notwithstanding, the main problem I think that underlies all of this is that Section 12 could have been used in this circumstance if Bridgewater State Hospital were considered a facility, which is defined under statute as a hospital that's run by or licensed by the Department of Mental Health. Massachusetts is one of only a very few states in this nation that has its chief forensic hospital under the care or under the jurisdiction of the state imprisonment agency, as it is here. This has been a sore thumb in the state's administration of mental health and criminal justice for generations. It resulted some years ago in some very onerous incidents involving the death of people, including a person that was basically sandwiched to death. There was litigation after that. There was a lot of agitation over it,
yep.
And the state refused to move the Bridgewater State Hospital from the Department of Correction to the Department of Mental Health. There have been bills pending. They haven't gone anywhere. That's the underlying problem here.
Thank you, Philip. So listen, just on our limited time, I am going to go back to Deb Becker for just a minute here now before we go. Deb, you know, this is somebody's death. This is happening also in a political context. We know Sheriff Hodgson is facing a challenge in next month's election from Attleboro Mayor Paul Heroux. Is this resonating in the district?
Mr. Heroux has issued a statement saying that the case of Adam Howe points to the need for better protection for those in the sheriff's custody. He calls this mismanagement of the Ash Street Jail. Sheriff Hodgson, who declined to speak with WBUR but told other media that he thinks Heroux is politicizing a tragedy, and his facilities are accredited by national accrediting agencies. So, yes, this will be an issue in this campaign for sheriff.
So, Deb, we've got about literally 30 seconds. I don't want to not get a chance to ask you what has struck you as a seasoned reporter the most about this case.
I think it's the finger pointing. The police saying one thing, the DA saying one thing, the jail saying one thing. I mean, everybody's saying it wasn't me. And it just really seems striking to me that someone with Mr. Howe's history and someone who clearly expressed suicidality, and it was in writing, apparently was not taken seriously enough to be more closely watched.
All right, WBUR's Deborah Becker there, and Philip Castle, Executive Director of the Mental Health Legal Advisors Committee. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And I'll say one more time, if you or a loved one are struggling with a mental health crisis or suicidal feelings, you can call the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988.
Anti-regime protests reignited this weekend across Iran. On the streets, at universities, and at schools.
That sound from CBS Evening News, October 9th. There have been weeks of protest in Iran following the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini. Amini was arrested in mid-September by Iran's morality police, who said that she wore her hijab improperly. According to the organization Iran Human Rights, at least 185 people have been killed in the protests. We talked to an Iranian student here in Boston who told us Iranian women have been out front during these protests, angry not just over this incident, but years of oppression and corruption. Pega is a Boston University graduate student who we spoke with as part of our series looking at students seeking a classroom away from conflict. Now, we're only using Pega's first name to protect her family back in Iran. And when we sat down in Studio 2, I started by asking her if her family is safe.
Yes, thank God, and they're safe, but we hardly communicate with each other because of the internet shutdown. And, I used to talk to my parents every day, but now it's not possible.
I'm sorry. Are you worried for their safety?
I would say everyone is in danger right now. People, those who go to the street to protest. You should be worried about that.
So let's talk about these protests. And I'm just going to, for our listeners, kind of remind them what the situation is. So on September 16, 22-year-old woman named Mahsa Amini dies. She was arrested on September 13th by Iran's morality police for ostensibly not wearing her hijab properly, was taken into custody. Her family says the death was a result of a beating while she was in police custody. The Iranian authorities dispute that. Now, that's all according to reporting by NPR. So when news of her death got out, women across Iran took to the streets in protest, burning hijabs, using the chant, "Women, life, freedom." Take me back to the moment when you first heard about what had happened and was happening.
First of all, I want to mention that she was wearing hijab, but according to the so-called morality police, it was not appropriate, which I don't think, I don't agree, because we saw pictures of her and that at the, from the day she was arrested, and the, her hijab, according to society, was acceptable. So when I heard this new news about Mahsa Amini, I felt for her, because I had been arrested, kind of arrested with these morality police. Not really arrested, but they came to me with and my sister in the street back home, and they disrespectfully talked to me. Or once in the international airport in Iran, they someone came to me and said, I was coming from abroad because I studied abroad before, and someone came to me and disrespectfully again talked to me that your hijab is not appropriate. I was wearing a scarf and I'm wearing a coat, which I think is acceptable in Iran. And I told her, told the guy that I'm wearing hijab, and he said, stop talking to me, and or else I will confiscate your passport and you cannot go back to your international school. Yeah, it bring all those memories to me, and all those inequality of women's in the Islamic Republic of Iran.
I can see that you feel very strongly.
Yeah.
Is it anger? Is it fear?
It's kind of anger, I think, that we cannot access basic human rights in Iran.
Is it very dangerous for the women who are protesting in the streets to be doing so?
Yes, it's very dangerous. They are facing bullets that is coming from the government. Yeah, that's very brave.
Do you know if you know anyone who's protesting?
Yes, a lot of my friends are protesting. It is, again, very dangerous, because if you post a picture on Instagram, they might go to you and arrest you, which happened to many of my friends back home.
Recently?
Yeah, yes, in those 2 weeks. Yeah.
In those couple of weeks, you had a number of friends who were arrested.
Yeah.
And they're safely back home now?
Some of them, yeah, but some of them, no.
2 years ago, were you in Iran at the time?
Yeah.
Could you have imagined 2 years ago these protests happening in the streets today?
Yeah. You know, this protest is not the first protest in Iran, but this one is stronger because people are more angry.
All right, let's come here now. So you're in the United States. You're at Boston University. This is happening back home. It resonates with you because you've had your own experience with the morality police. And that felt arbitrary, unjust to you. Is there a piece of you that wishes you were there now?
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
I could have helped my people. And I know that if the people are more in the street, the government might be more scared. On the other hand, I'm happy that I'm here and I can be their voice. The more we talk about them, we will send energy to my people back home. And if they know that people are supporting them out of Iran, they will be stronger and they will continue against this tyranny.
Pega, this is a good time to remind listeners that we are using only your first name in this conversation, because you're genuinely concerned for the safety of your family in Iran.
Thank you so much.
And you believe that this is the kind of conversation that could get back home if you're not careful.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely.
So why did you decide to talk to us?
I want to be their voice, and I want people in Western countries be our voice. We want to be heard.
Have you found an Iranian community here in Greater Boston?
Yes, until now. I think we had 3 protests in Boston. 2 were in Boston Common, and one was in Harvard.
At the Harvard Square Bridge?
Yeah.
And does that make you feel a little closer to home?
Yeah, exactly. It feels so good to be united.
And what about friends, people at the university, people in your community who are not Iranian? Have you felt support?
Right now, yeah, everyone that knows I'm Iranian would ask me, oh, are you okay? We heard about Iran. But at first, I felt so lonely. That's why I reached out to BU, actually emailed the dean of my school.
What did you say to the dean of your school?
He didn't know about this tragedy, and I sent an email to him, the subject, the tragedy happening in Iran. And I explained to him, and then I asked him that to be out my voice. And he was so sad, and he posted a tweet. Yeah, I felt so good, and I'm very grateful to be here in Boston, in Boston University. It feels so good to have the freedom of speech. I'm really happy that I can talk and people listen to me, which is a crime in Iran.
So what do you most want people who hear you to understand?
I want people to know that it's not just about hijab or any specific religion. Iranian government has been oppressing minorities and women for a long time. Being silent at this moment, I believe, means that you're supporting Iranian government.
So many women and girls in the last few weeks have put themselves at risk.
Yeah.
On the streets in Iran.
Yes.
To protest what's happening. Do you believe something might change this time?
I think so, yeah. And I hope so. I think this protest is different from others. I think it's like a women's revolution.
That was Pega, a student at Boston University. And again, we're only using her first name to protect her family in Iran. Question 4 on the Massachusetts ballot asks voters if they want to keep a new state law that allows undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. Massachusetts became the 17th state to adopt such a law back in June. It's set to go into effect next year. WBUR's Walter Wuthman begins our story on question 4 in Waltham, at the home of the woman with a deep personal stake in the issue.
My name is Zoila Lopez, and I'm from Guatemala.
Lopez sits at the kitchen table of her Waltham apartment. Her home is neat, decorated with throw pillows and pictures of family. Lopez came to the United States illegally over 30 years ago, escaping Guatemala's violent civil war.
For many, many years, it was very difficult for me to live in this country with no status.
Her immigration status also meant she could not obtain a driver's license. That made it hard for her to get to work and take care of her kids.
It was so difficult for me to take my children to see the doctor, to take my children to the hospital.
Lopez says she was also afraid of talking to police without any official identification. And that became a problem when the father of one of her children became abusive.
I was trying to go away, but I have no driver license to go away. I have no car. I have no how to put myself safe.
Lopez says her partner came home one night and struck her in the head, knocking her unconscious. She later called 911 and police arrested him. Lopez then went to court and secured a special visa for victims of crime who cooperate with police. She says that visa and the driver's license it allowed her to secure changed her life. She's no longer afraid of being stopped by police.
I have something on my hand that I can give it to them and tell this is me, and I be allowed to be on the street.
Lopez is now fighting efforts to repeal the law allowing other immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. And many in law enforcement agree with her.
It just makes a whole lot of sense.
That's South Hadley Police Chief Jennifer Gunderson.
I mean, from my perspective, I want to know that every motorist out on the roadway is educated on the rules of the road. You know, I want to know that every motorist on the roadway has insurance.
Gunderson points to data showing hit-and-run accidents fell in California and Connecticut after their legislatures passed similar laws.
When those other states have allowed undocumented persons to get licenses, they come out by the thousands to get educated, to get insured, to have their cars inspected. They come out by the thousands.
But opponents believe providing undocumented people with licenses rewards illegal activity. Maureen Maloney and her organization Fair and Secure Massachusetts are spearheading the campaign to overturn the law.
Yearly for, I don't even know how many years, I've been testifying against the driver's license for illegal aliens bill.
Maloney says she's motivated by personal experience. Her son, Matthew Denise, was killed in 2011 by a drunk driver who was in the country illegally. She believes the ability to apply for a driver's license will encourage more people to cross the border.
I oppose rewarding somebody being in the country illegally with a driver's license, with allowing them to work. I oppose rewards for them across the board.
Opponents also fear giving licenses to undocumented people could lead to voter fraud. But Secretary of State Bill Galvin says there are already safeguards that prevent people who aren't citizens from registering to vote. That includes immigrants who are here legally and already able to obtain driver's licenses. Back in Waltham, Lopez says she has family, friends, and neighbors who can't wait to apply.
Well, it's many, many people. They wish and pray to have at least a driver's license.
The Pew Center estimates there are 250,000 undocumented immigrants in Massachusetts. That means if a majority of Massachusetts voters vote to keep the law, thousands will be eligible to apply for licenses in July. But if a majority votes no, the law will be repealed, and they will be blocked from getting licenses once again.
That report from WBUR's Walter Wuthman. And you can hear a full debate on question 4 from last Friday's Radio Boston on our website, radioboston.org. And also tune in this Friday. We will host a debate on ballot question 1, the Fair Share Amendment, or sometimes called the Millionaire's Tax. Tonight, Christ Church in Cambridge will host a special event to honor a man who shares a crypt with two people who enslaved his parents and him at birth. It is a multimedia installation commemorating Darby Vassall, his life and its death, his ties to Harvard University and the historic Longfellow House in Cambridge, and his commitment to activism once free. Dennis Lloyd and his daughter, Egypt, are Vassall's descendants. They hail from Roxbury and founded the Slave Legacy History Coalition, which is an organization that aims to help other descendants learn about their past and to spread awareness of the history of slavery. So the two stopped by Studio 2 yesterday, along with Christopher Began, the site manager at the Longfellow House, which is a National Historic Site. The Longfellow House contacted the Lloyd family while looking into its own history with slavery. As we sat down, I asked Chris to tell us more about who Darby Vassall was.
Oh, boy. That's a big question to start out with. So Darby Vassall was born into slavery in the Vassall House in 1769. He was separated from his family when he was very young, when his enslavers sold him from Cambridge to a family in Woburn. He seized his own freedom around the time of the American Revolution. And even reported that he met George Washington in his lifetime. And later in life, he was an activist. He worked to create a social safety net for other free blacks in the greater Boston area, worked to found the African Society, a mutual aid organization, worked to establish educational opportunities for free black people in Boston, was even a property owner in Boston, really went on to lead a remarkable life coming from slavery. And in the last year of his life, he even signed a petition protecting people against the Fugitive Slave Act. And he died in 1861, just before the American Civil War.
And well into his 90s, if I understand.
Well into his 90s. He was 91 or 92 at the time of his death.
And legend has it that he didn't just meet George Washington, but when George Washington asked him as a child to work without pay, he said, no.
Absolutely. Yeah. He, you know, even as a six-ish year old boy, he was a little activist. You know, and Washington was coming from a very, very different part of the country. You know, he wasn't used to seeing free black members of society. So that was a real eye-opener for Washington, I imagine.
So, Dennis, when I talked about that legend, you chuckled. So when did you find out that you were a descendant of Darby Vassall?
Actually, it was the summer of 2020. A young lady who was then an undergraduate at Harvard University, Carissa Chin, contacted one of my daughters and inquired, you know, was she, set, were you Jordan Lloyd? And Jordan asked why. She explained that she had been doing some research and on Harvard's connection to slavery and found out that she may be related to Cooper and Tony Vassall. So that was the first step. We had, prior to that, though, we had knowledge of our ancestry in terms of connection to the Vassal family, but it never went as extensive as what Carissa unveiled to us.
So Cuba and Tony were Darby's parents and were enslaved in the Vassal household, eventually became free themselves, owned property in the Cambridge area too.
Yes, correct.
And Egypt, when you found out you had this descendant, yes. What was your first reaction?
I was very humbled. It's very remarkable. And it's very blessed that I'm finding this information out at this point in my life, being that I'm a 40-year-old woman, I'm just finding this out. I have two young girls, Leah, age 12, and my oldest, Noelle, 15. And for them to learn their history that we're with our family being tied to enslavement is such a blessing. There's so many people out there that cannot connect their heritage because of slavery. So for us to know where our family was enslaved at, by who, and what location, that's a blessing that my kids will know where to go and what their ancestors did prior to them. So it's a blessing, you know, and I'm glad they learned at an early age.
Is that how you feel about it too, Dennis?
I do. I mean, given all the millions of African Americans that were enslaved in the United States, we are among a very few family, you know, in terms of family, that actually can trace their family's heritage, as Egypt pointed out, from the time our family arrived to whom brought them here, to where they worked, where they died, and where they are buried. Matter of fact, at Christ Church, there will be an unveiling of a video that was done surrounding the burial place for Darby Vassal. And the segment is called Here Lies Darby Vassal.
So let's pick it back up with you then, Chris. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that, because this burial is a remarkable thing.
It absolutely is. Yeah, Darby Vassal was chose to be buried in the tomb of his enslavers in Christ Church in Cambridge. So he is buried under Christ Church with the white Vassal family who enslaved him at the time of his birth. Really a unique circumstance. So a Harvard Graduate School of Design student, Nicole Pippenbrink, learned about this history and has created this audiovisual exhibit outside of Christ Church to honor his memory. It's going to be launching on October 12th, which is the anniversary of Darby Vassal's death. I think it asks the public to reflect on his life.
Absolutely.
You know, his accomplishments, the way he was treated in his lifetime, and so, you know, some of his own choices in life, you know, to be an activist and ultimately to be buried where he was buried.
And Chris, he was invited to be buried in that family tomb by a descendant of the people who had enslaved Cuba and Tony, his parents.
That's correct.
The only words that really come to me, Egypt, for that choice, his choice to accept that invitation, it's a little bit colloquial, but that is a flex and a half of who you are and your power to say, I will accept that invitation, I will make this choice. That is remarkable.
Yes, it is. And it just tells you his spirituality, that he loved the Lord. And it's better for him to have been buried in a church than an open field. We might never know where he is being buried at. It's fascinating for my kids to see this. You know, my dad is learning this information at his stage of age and mine. But again, you know, my children are very fortunate to know this. And for us to have been a part of the filming that Nicole Pippenbrink did, me and my father and my stepmother, Beverly Laura Parks, that was a blessing too in itself. So we don't take this lightly. We know that there are many more Darby Vassals out there that people will maybe not ever hear of. No, we cannot forget about them too as well. But we don't take it lightly.
So now you've got grandchildren who understand a piece of their history, know it for sure. In a way you never did in your young adulthood.
Correct, correct. Although I will say, I would offer this bit of advice to younger people, and even people as you move into your 40s and 50s, pay attention to what your older relatives tell you. Yeah. There were many times when my mother and my aunt would tell me stories and I would dismiss it, you know, and so I'm sorry I did do
stories
that.
Stories about your ancestor.
Exactly, stories about my ancestor. Mm-hmm. But no, so this information now certainly comes at a very appropriate time, and we, you know, have embraced it. We have, you know, carried it forward. One of the strong points of Darby Vassal's existence in his life was that he was an activist, as Chris pointed out.
Absolutely.
And so we've continued that in the sense of creating the Slave Legacy History Coalition, mm-hmm. which rather than just finding out about our ancestry, we wanted to go forward and begin to see how we could cultivate and, you know, and extend the knowledge of enslavement and the history of it to other people.
We're speaking with Dennis and Egypt Lloyd, who are founders, co-founders of the Slave Legacy History Coalition, as Dennis just mentioned. Also, Chris Began, who's the site manager at the Longfellow House. And we're talking about this found history, really, of Dennis and Egypt's relation to Darby Vassal, who was enslaved by the Vassal family, prominent benefactors of Harvard University. Later in his freedom, became a prominent activist and citizen in his community. So we have these two things now, Chris, happening at the same time. We have institutions in our community, like Longfellow House, really trying to examine history.
The early 2000s was the first time the then site manager at the time, Jim Shea, dove into understanding the history of enslavement of the property and made some connections with Dennis's cousin at that time through research on an online genealogy database. And that was when kind of the floodgates opened, if you will, and we learned a lot more over the intervening 20 or so years. For us, a real watershed moment was in summer of 2021 when we met Dennis in Egypt for the first time. And they took on the task of convening the coalition to bring a variety of institutions and individuals together to, you know, to continue that mission of educating about slavery.
Tell me about that meeting. You all meet for the first time. It's 2021.
It was powerful. It was a lot of emotions going in because here we are just learning the history of our ancestors and then coming, bringing different individuals and institutions together. So it was a lot of emotions going to play. But what I will tell you that it made me more dedicated into teaching my children their history. It needs to start at home. And the fact that I'm bringing my children along, my child is here with me right now, so she can actually see her mother doing the work and not just preaching to her about doing the work. So with all that, it definitely makes you to be humble and know where you should focus your time and efforts to. Dad?
Yes, it was a very certainly powerful moment for us.
Yeah.
In addition to learning the history of our family in depth, we've developed some wonderful friendships.
Mm-hmm.
We've developed a wonderful friendship with the Longfellow House, other institutions, churches within the Cambridge area, staff at History Cambridge, the Cambridge Black Genealogical Society. And, you know, so there's many, many offshoots of what occurred at the Longfellow House. Mm-hmm. Most importantly, though, is that once you begin to understand your history and look around, you understand, you know, your place, I find, you know, in society, you know, that you're very fortunate. Our ancestors, as slaves coming here, struggled, you know. We can't take that lightly. So at this point in my life, and certainly we encourage, you know, grandchildren, children, to just carry the banner of making sure that positivity is within our reach all the time in everything that we do. And so that's an offshoot of learning about our history, and in addition to just the genealogy of it.
So I'm struck by the grappling and the truth-telling that some major institutions, like a Longfellow House, like a Harvard University, we know Georgetown and Brown and other universities are doing something similar, that literally must, I think, Chris, to some extent, tear down some preconceived notions. So for example, in preparing for today and reading about the history of many of Harvard's benefactors, you know, in Boston, we like to tell our story as an abolitionist story. Mm-hmm. But so much of the early wealth associated with Harvard came from people participating in the slave trade, right? That's just the way it was.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so to grapple with that and sort of tear down a piece of what we've told ourselves about who we are, while simultaneously building up people who didn't know their history, that is an important dynamic and shift.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it, you know, it really, Northern slavery is a revelation to a lot of people. I mean, we see that in visitors to the Longfellow House. I see that myself. I mean, I grew up in Virginia and I was taught Northern abolitionists, Southern enslavers, but the truth of the matter isn't so clean cut. You know, over the hundreds of years that people were enslaved in this country, there were a lot of shifting dynamics that happened in our, you know, political landscape, in our social landscape, in our physical landscape. And, you know, we see visitors who are surprised to learn that. And we also see some visitors who are seeking out opportunities to learn more about slavery in New England. You know, to your second point, I think it's tough. So, you know, the National Park Service, it didn't exist, right, in colonial America. It didn't exist, until a century ago. So it's a little bit of a different dynamic than some municipalities and academic institutions that have kind of have that longevity and their ties to the history of slavery. But we do share with them, you know, a mission of education, right, of sharing with the public sort of the clear picture of the past so that we can use that to inform a better future.
Dennis, you're originally from Roxbury.
I am.
So I found myself thinking a couple of weeks ago, we had two people sitting right where you're sitting now,
yes.
The pastor of 12th Baptist Church and the chief of archaeology for the city of Boston. Mm-hmm. And the chief of archaeology was talking about a dig that they had just completed where they believed they found evidence of enslaved quarters in a local house and were beginning to do the work. 12th Baptist was offering to be part of doing the work of deciding what to do with those artifacts now. What is the work now of a community like Boston in your mind?
Well, first of all, I do know Reverend Broderick, you know, at 12th Baptist. So, and I know that, you know, his insight as to what the direction of that dig should be about is right on point. But let me just, can I just backtrack one thing?
Yes.
2 weeks ago, my daughter Egypt and I participated in a panel with Harvard University at the University of Virginia, and it was called The Landscape of Slavery. So we were in Charlottesville, and there were a number of descendants were there who were enslaved by Thomas Jefferson, as you know, was the founder of the University of Virginia, and the framer of the Declaration of Independence. And we all shared the same, you know, enthusiasm about the revelation of learning the history of our ancestors and wanting to find more. So when you hear efforts of what is happening here in Boston with the dig, it's very encouraging.
So Egypt, last word to you. What's the most important next step in this work in your mind?
For us to continue to leave a good legacy, first of all, for my kids and for our other family members, to keep Darby Vassell's voice alive. You know, he's still living today through my dad, through me, and through my kids. We're still continuing to work. That's why we have the Slave Legacy History Coalition, and we're going to keep it going, you know, and I hope my kids will do the same as well.
All right, Egypt Lloyd and Dennis Lloyd, descendants of Darby Vassell, and Longfellow House site manager Chris Began, thanks to all three of you.
Thank you for
Thank
having
you so
us.
Much.
Thank you very much.
The Here Lies Darby Vassell installation will be unveiled today at Christ Church in Cambridge at 6 p.m. And you can find more information about the event at hereliesdarbyvassell.art. So that's Darby, D-A-R-B-Y, Vassell, V-A-S-S-A-L-L.art. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks so much for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.